We are really lucky to have such a diversity of wildlife here in Wisconsin. I think it's really part of our culture to notice and appreciate what's going on around us in different seasons with our wildlife. And we are fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven come by once a month to share what he's been seeing, help us understand what's going on out there, and, of course, answer your questions when you call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo or a question or a comment on my Facebook page. Love to see you there at the Larry Mueller Show. And Scott, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Good to be here again. Geez, still hot, still dry in some places, but hey, wildlife seems to be hanging in there, and
I think
fall isn't that far away.
Yeah, the drought, the rain that we've had recently in parts of Wisconsin have been very helpful.
Yes, I spent a little time up in Price County last week at the cabin, and it's still jungle-like up there. They've had lots of rain and almost continuous rain, but as you move south, get down around Stevens Point, starts to dry out in a hurry. But even around here, the people who have been lucky enough to be under a thunderstorm, some of the corn's looking halfway decent at least. And yeah, it's good news. I mean, though, we talked on the last program about Dunn's Marsh, for example, just disappearing. And after that big rain of a couple of weeks ago, it filled up overnight. That's not going to help some of the amphibians and turtles and things that probably vacated the premises, but at least there's water there again.
Yep, there's water there. And that's a good thing. And here we are, August 1st, which is also a deadline time for the DNR.
Oh, it's an important time for people looking ahead to fall or even later in terms of permit applications for various hunts that are coming up. For example, let's see here on my master sheet. Today is the deadline for Horicon Zone goose permits, fall turkey permits, otter and fisher tags, the sharp-tail grouse hunt, the Upland Lake sturgeon spearing permit, and bobcat. And I believe today is also the day that historically the first wolf permits for the hunt start up today. The applications, and then they'll decide who's going to actually receive permits depending on how many applications are purchased and submitted. So we'll see how that all plays out. But anyway, if you're interested in any of these things we mentioned, you've got plenty of time on the wolf situation because that's a start rather than a deadline. But if you want any of those other applications, time to get them in today.
And, you know, as long as we're talking about the DNR, Tim in Hortonville has something relating to one of the reports that relates to the DNR. Tim, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's on your mind?
Well, with the deer report that came out, I guess the concept that it's probably difficult to count deer in the small management units, I would have to agree with. My experience last year was that I sat in my stand opening day for less than an hour, and my son shot a deer, and so I had to go over and help him, and I sat in another stand for a matter of an hour and a half, and I saw plenty more deer and shot a buck. And so in the process of 3 hours, I probably saw 15 deer. Mm-hmm. I sat for 4 more days and never saw another deer on the same area.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the deer have become pretty conditioned to being hunted a lot with the number of doe tags that are available, and so it's difficult to count them. So I'd agree with that, and I also agree that the concept that the hunters want more deer, but we can't handle more deer. I think there's going to be a happy medium in there. My concern still is I hope that we never get to a point in the state of Wisconsin where our public lands are privatized, because then at that point in time, I don't think any report for deer management matters, because it's going to be really a have and a have-not sport. So I'll hang up and let you go from there.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, Larry, there are a couple of things there. First of all, there has been a lot of talk generated by the deer report, and apparently there was a day-long session that the DNR hosted yesterday with a large number of stakeholders trying to see where things were headed with this. And, of course, there are, as we've talked about before, nearly as many opinions as there are hunters, landowners, and other people in the various interest groups. I just hope there were some good things, some good ideas in the report. Some of the things that seemed to gain traction, though, weren't in the report, and one is this notion that somehow the Deer Czar was going to recommend that our public lands become, I don't know, somehow privatized or closed up or something, and he didn't say anything about that. In fact, he supports the kind of a system we have. So I think people should stop worrying about that. Our public hunting grounds, our parks, our state, county, and national forests, all the places that people do a lot besides hunt deer are, I think, going to stay just as they
are.
There's no need for anxiety over that particular issue. Some of the things about counting deer and whether it's easy or difficult will take a long time to sort out. There are probably a few things in the report that similarly could be looked at as low-hanging fruit and be implemented without great pain or use of resources. So, excuse me, I'm just hoping that this sorts out fairly quickly and we start to see some of the things that can be done quickly and that the public is given the proper perception, I guess, that some of the other ideas, like revamping the deer management units or this so-called DMAP, the Deer Management Assistance Program for private landowners, may take a long time to implement. And it may not be the answer for Wisconsin that it has been in some other states, and even in some of the states where that particular program is popular, it still affects relatively small areas of the landscape and primarily large landowners. So we'll see how it all plays out, but it's an interesting exercise in the democracy of deer management.
And actually, Operation Deer Watch, he was talking about watching deer, that starts today and it runs through September 30th.
Yeah, that's kind of a neat situation that was put in effect in a very systematic way last year. But the DNR has been collecting deer observations for almost 50 years in terms of guiding deer management. But Project Deer Watch does start today, runs through the 30th. People who are interested in essentially participating in the citizen science project are asked to record all deer observations that they make, categorizing the deer as bucks, does, fawns, unknown, and so forth, and related information, and then submit that to the DNR. And information like, for example, how many fawns people are seeing with does is very useful every year. And will become more useful as they amass a large data set as more and more people participate in this. So it's kind of fun to do. Over the long haul, it will be very enlightening as far as what's going on with the deer herd in the state. And to participate, you can go to the new DNR webpage and keyword search Deer Watch, and then there's a link for online wildlife surveys, and you can get going in this in a big way. I think last year, I want to say they had something like 6,000-7,000 citizen observations. So
hopefully they'll have more this year.
For people who are driving a lot or watching out the window, here's something you can do instead of just over dinner saying, hey, I saw a big buck in velvet. Well, pass that on to the DNR, and it'll be helpful.
Let's take some calls. Mary Sue in West Bend, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling about raccoons. When I was putting jelly out for the birds, when I'd forget to take it in by 8:30 or 9 at night, I would have visiting raccoons who would be happy to finish up anything that was left on the saucers. And of course, they were climbing up from the ground up my deck poles, you know, the supporting structures, and then getting up there. And so, you know, they've kind of left their tracks all around and everything. And friends have been telling me that a lot of raccoons are rabid and that I should be very careful in wiping off their paw marks and things like that. And I'm wondering if this is true and if there's any danger whatsoever if a person had an open sore on their hand or something of catching anything from raccoons.
Okay, well, Mary Sue, first of all, I'm glad you brought up raccoons because there are three mammals that just seem to be doing very, very well this year and causing lots of people grief and anxiety. One is raccoons, and the other ones that will probably come up throughout the program are 13-line ground squirrels or striped gophers, as some people call them, and rabbits. They seem to be everywhere this year. So whatever's happened has agreed with those animals, and they're doing very well. Now, as a general matter of course, I think it's a very good idea when you have any contact with any wild animals, whether it's contact with their feces or they've been rolling around in something, any contact at all, cleaning out a live trap, cleaning out a feeder, it's a very good idea. In fact, it's essential to just practice everything you can do in terms of normal sanitary procedures, in terms of washing up thoroughly after such exposure, using hand sanitizer, whatever you would normally do, do it. In terms of any particular risk from raccoons and rabies, that is not something that I think you need to be overly worried about, especially from just contact with tracks or some such thing. First of all, raccoon rabies is not a huge issue in Wisconsin yet. It was more of an issue to the east of us, and the transmission is not usually the way you describe it. So that's among the various things you might be concerned about, and there are other parasites and diseases that raccoons are involved with that might affect your pets, or roundworm parasite that might affect even kids or whatever. All good reasons for the sanitation, but given some common sense procedures to protect yourselves, it's nothing you should lose any sleep over.
Okay, so those saucers that they licked off, I'm not going to catch anything from just bringing them in and washing them off.
No, you should bring them in and wash them off.
Yeah.
You might have a little fun one time if you've got some Tabasco and put a little Tabasco in that grape jelly. The birds don't notice it, but the raccoons would.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, the birds are about done with the grape jelly now, but I'll remember that for next year.
Yeah, usually one time at least gets rid of the one raccoon that gets to lick on it. He doesn't come back. Art in Fifield, your turn. Hi, Art. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, fellas.
Morning.
Good morning.
I'm west of Fifield on Highway 70 out near the Oxbow.
Mm-hmm.
Scott knows where I am. We've talked previously.
Yeah, my place is at the other end of Fifield, over by the Turtle Flambeau. Anyway, go ahead.
Great country up here. We have a back stoop, a wooden back stoop with a roof over it that's 6 by 8 feet, raised a little bit off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I got a colony of snakes living under the stoop.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to sun themselves on the stoop, and Mary, of course, is concerned that they will charge into the house when the screen door is open.
Okay.
How do I get them out of there and keep them out of there without doing bodily harm to them?
What do you know what they are, Art? Can you describe them?
They're grass snakes. They're garter snakes.
So just the dark-colored ones with the longitudinal or lengthwise stripes?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're absolutely harmless, although the shock value of stepping out the door and seeing a seething mass of them might cause some people a bit of a start. But I think the first thing to do is attempt to get them out from under there so that you can implement the long-term solution, which is to – that stoop doesn't sound so large that you couldn't do a little excavation along the edge line and then sink – a quarter-inch hardware cloth or galvanized screen barrier down there so that the snakes simply couldn't get in and use that. And in order to get them out, what you have to be concerned about is whether or not they have access. Do you have a finished basement?
I have a crawl space basement.
Okay, well, you need to be – is there any indication that they actually spend the winter under there, or that area in the crawl space is their hibernaculum where they may spend the winter and then emerge again in the spring?
No. We get down in that crawl space area to change water filters and do other things, and I don't think they're inside.
Okay, well, that's good then, because what you have two options. One is to wait until things get cold and those snakes move off then to wherever their hibernaculum is. And it could be somebody else's old well. It could be a barn foundation. It could be just about anywhere. They may move several miles. But once you're fairly soon they're sure that they're gone, say in October, early November, before the ground freezes, then that's a perfect time to do a little trenching there and put a barrier down, 6-8 inches into the soil and flanged or bent outward from the stoop so that they can't, force their way through the loose soil and get back in there, and make it tight up against the wall or back it so that they're not coming through the crawl space either. That's the long-term solution. In the short run, They can be physically removed, and get yourself a snake hook or a tongs, or if you're not nervous about picking them up, just use some gloves and relocate them. Or there's actually a couple commercial products on the market. One is called Dr. T's Snake Away, and you could find this easily on the internet. It's a granular product that if you throw a couple handfuls of it under there, it may cause them to vacate the area long enough for you to do the longer-term work. And that's about the size of it. But you need to build them out of there, and there are a couple ways. You can either wait them out until they leave on their own or find one of these snake repellents that may encourage them to move out.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin and UW Extension. Our guest here, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist. Scott, we were talking about repellents for some things, and there's a new deer repellent out that has a lot of promise.
Well, you mentioned the hot pepper sauce in the in the raccoon dish, and actually capsaicin, which is the active ingredient in hot pepper sauce, it's what makes hot pepper sauce or hot peppers hot, is the active ingredient for a couple of commercial repellents. And there's been some email traffic just recently of a newer repellent on the market called Repellex, R-E-P-E-L-L-E-X.
R-E-P-E-L-L-E-X, okay.
Which is the active ingredient, again, is capsaicin, the hot pepper sauce stuff. But the difference between this one, as opposed to spraying it or putting it in a dish, this is actually a tablet product or a pelletized product that you put in that systemically is supposedly absorbed by your plants that you're trying to protect from browsing by rabbits or deer or anything else that's nibbling on the plants. So you'd say put one of these things next to your prize hosta, and it presumably absorbs the capsaicin, and now your hosta tastes like a jalapeno or a habanero, and the rabbits and deer leave it alone. Now, the call that went out was for people who have firsthand experience with this, you know, hey, let's hear what you think of it. It may be too early to tell, but I was just curious, A, to mention it, people might want to give it a try, if you have any experience with it, we'd sure like to know about it.
I wonder if would it work for shrubs, you know, like bushes or things like that?
Well, the entry here that I received is kind of cryptic, but I assume the label instructions would indicate what species of plants or size of plants and how long it actually takes before you apply it, before the plant is theoretically protected. And whether or not it protects, let's say you've got a flowering shrub, it may protect the new foliage and leaves during the summer, but does that also impart protection on the twigs when the rabbits and voles and deer are munching on them during the winter? I don't know, but we'll have to see how this plays out. But it could be one that gets it could be a repellent that gets away from the problem of lousy weathering. You know, you spray the stuff on, then it rains, and it's gone, and you put it on again, it gets kind of expensive. This one seems to have some more longer-term promise. So
Sounds good. Sounds interesting. Let's see. We have an email from Rob. There's a bird always sitting on a beach on Lake Onalaska near La Crosse in the vicinity of many bald eagles up in the trees. It's about 24 to 30 inches tall, solid brown body with a darker head. Thought it was a juvenile ball, but it's quite a bit bigger than them. It's fat like a wild turkey with a wingspan about 5 feet. Doesn't have an underbelly that's mixed brown and white. It has an underbelly that's mixed brown and white. A golden by chance?
I guess I'd like to hear something about the beak and whether it appears to be, a raptor or a member of the heron family or some other of the large birds. But the description, if he describes it as being as large or as large as a bald eagle, then certainly a golden eagle, especially over along the western part of the state, is a possibility.
Definitely a possibility. Yeah. Marcella in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
Thank you. We have a yard that's about a little bit less than an acre, but it's in a pretty busy area of Green Bay. Mm-hmm. And our neighbor is feeding some wild turkeys that live in our yard. And it was awful cute a couple months ago because they were small. But now there's about 12 babies that are like almost as big as partridges and three adults that are very big birds.
Mm-hmm.
And she's saying she's doing it because the drought. She's providing food and water for them, but they're walking around our yard, and it looks to me like they're going to outgrow the yard pretty quickly. And I'm just wondering if that's the best thing we should do during the drought, or if we should try something else. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. And everybody, when some sort of a disaster, whether it's deep snow or drought or whatever, wants to help. And there are some things that, in terms of keeping your bird feeders full and all for the songbirds, may be useful. But generally speaking, feeding for some of the larger things, especially mammals, and for something as big as a turkey, starts to cause some difficulties. And it gets them concentrated, it gets them habituated to people, and puts them in harm's way around traffic and so forth. So generally speaking, if you've got a bird feeder out and it's spilled grain, you can't do much about turkeys or pheasants visiting the feeder, and that's fine. I had a brood of pheasants in the yard day before yesterday. It was pretty cool. I haven't seen a good-sized brood of pheasants with the rooster and the hen present for a long time. So I said, oh, God, there's pheasants in the yard, and they were running every which way. It was kind of neat. But in terms of intentionally trying to feed turkeys, you know, that's the kind of thing that caused problems way back when with the turkey restoration efforts
that failed early on
because people were treating them like barnyard turkeys, and they really shouldn't be. They're a wild bird. The good news here is as they grow, they are going to essentially outpace a one-acre backyard, and they'll go elsewhere in all probability. But I don't think there'd be any harm in hastening that process by cutting back on the food provision.
Well, they'll leave a fair amount of waste. You got 15 turkeys.
And it can be messy, and sometimes maybe a little noisy or otherwise disruptive. They are neat to see, but I think that people need to be happy with the occasional sightings they get without necessarily bringing them into a big pile of food.
So you can cite Scott and Larry to your neighbor.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Marilyn in Cleveland. Hello.
Hello. I have a problem with my cat was an indoor-outdoor cat, and the other night I heard coyotes howling, and she was out. And they were across the road. I live out in the country. And my question is she in danger? Will coyotes kill cats?
Absolutely. They enjoy cats. They pursue cats with great vigor in some parts of the country. And certainly will here in Wisconsin, too. And you know what? The only way to ensure that that doesn't happen is to keep your cat inside.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. And here's an email from Ann that actually relates to that. I've heard it implied several times that only small dogs are in danger from coyotes, yet it's my experience in Arizona that coyotes would follow my 60-pound spayed German Shepherd and me while we hiked. Perhaps they were interested in something besides an easy meal. Could competition have been an issue?
We've had over the years, Larry, we've had all sorts of reports of coyotes playing with. I mean, we've had people send video clips of coyotes, in quotes, playing with their Labrador retrievers or whatever in the backyard. The intentions of the coyotes are rather hard to determine, but coyotes do breed with some larger dogs occasionally, so we end up with what we call coy dogs in some parts of the country. And there may be territorial issues and other problems. The real risk in terms of an animal being taken away as a food item is for the smaller dogs. But if coyotes are around, a little bit of caution is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And if you got cats, keep them inside.
Yeah.
Dana in Superior has got a review for us of Repelex.
Yes, it's wonderful. I got it down at a Dan's feed bin, a feed store, and had talked to a few people about it. And I knew I did it for hostas. I have a lot of hostas and a lot of deer. I live out in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And you put it in the ground, you know, so many inches down as the buds are just starting to come up.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it tells you, you know, for a plant that's going to be this size or this tall and this wide, how many you plant next to them or very next to them. And then just water them. And I did not have one problem with any of my hostas. And a
As
lot of
compared
them are,
to previous years?
Correct. So,
do you have any sense of once you apply these tablets, how long they're supposed? How long does it take before the plant achieves some protection? And B, how long is it supposed to protect the plant?
They say it protects it throughout the year. You know, throughout your growing.
So it's a growing season issue. Yeah. Yep.
And that's why when you first start seeing the buds come up, that's when you're supposed to do it, because as you water, it absorbs through, you know, into the plant
as
right away.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts protecting it when it's, you know, just starting out. I had problems with rabbits, you know, chewing off the tops of them when they're just starting to come up.
Mm-hmm.
I saw just a little nibble on a couple of them, and then that was it.
Yeah,
so
presumably the animal has to make a little nibble to decide,
right.
Holy cow, this hosta doesn't taste like it used to. So.
Exactly. And it was wonderful. I didn't have a problem with not one of my hostas last year, so I did again this year, and I'm doing just great.
Oh, that's wonderful news.
Thank you very much for calling.
You know,
I often throughout my career, I was reluctant to use testimonials to any great extent, because we always wanted to see the data that suggested that, yes, 18 deer were exposed to these treated hostas and only one of them nibbled and so forth. However, the public is very much moved by testimonials because they like to hear that somebody either had good luck or bad luck. And in this case, sounds like it helped you. So.
That is it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks
for calling. Thanks a lot, Dana, for calling. So Repellex, R-E-P-E-L-L-E-X. But not that we don't have any stock in the company or anything.
This isn't an endorsement. We talk about a variety of products from time to time because hopefully it helps people solve some of these nagging wildlife issues. But this was one that I happened to see recently. So according to Dana? Sounds good.
And according to Pat in Superior,
She
called to say that she used Repellex to protect clematis, or clematis, as you want to call it, and rhododendron, and it worked great.
Hmm.
So there's another.
Both from Superior. There must be a good marketing group out there in that area. Okay.
Okay. This is Dana's chance in Highland next. Hi, Dana.
Hi. I have a question about the ground squirrels or the gophers.
Okay, we knew this was inevitable. Go ahead.
I have a lot of them in my orchard, and I'm wondering what the best, if there's a poison I can put down their holes for them, if there's a certain trap I can get for them, or especially if there is a trap, what maybe their favorite foods would be to attract them to the trap.
Okay.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, well, we knew this was coming, Larry, so I might as well say, at least based on my backyard experience, it is a bad year for 13-line ground squirrels or striped gophers. I'm seeing them scurrying around. It just seems like they're all over the place, which, you know, as long as they're not hassling my garden, I'm more tolerant of them than the rabbits right now. But my black lab, Shelby, has taken it upon herself to excavate every ground squirrel residence that she can find, and it's beginning to look like a moonscape around the yard with craters and potholes, so I have to do something, and the options are several. For one thing, if you can get a hose to the burrows are about the size of a 50-cent piece or silver dollar, and they're notoriously shallow. So if the animal's in the burrow, they can be flooded out of that burrow fairly easily with a garden hose. And then once you bring them to the surface with the water, you'll have to decide how you want to deal with them. They can be caught in several different types of traps. They can be caught in small live traps that are kind of jammed over the entrance to the burrow, or you create a little funnel that leads into the trap and caught that way, or they're very vulnerable to a rat trap, a plain old wooden base snap-type rat trap baited with peanut butter. And it's so hot that the peanut butter turns very loose very quickly. So take a little piece of cloth, tie it tightly on the trigger, just a little piece about the size of the trigger, and then smear the peanut butter into that so that it sticks on the cloth and the animal has to actually tug on it a little bit. It makes the trap much more effective. Problem with rat traps is you start putting these things out in the open, other things will be attracted to the peanut butter. Could be some ground-feeding birds, could be other mammals you don't want to trap. So be careful, or it could be kids that are just playing the trap. So be really careful if you're going to do that, where you put them and how you put them out so that they're under a leaning piece of wood or under a cardboard box or something so that there's no harm to non-targets other than the ground squirrels. And then finally, in a larger scale, and I think Dana mentioned an orchard. If you've got to protect more than a backyard, there are some rodenticides that can be, read the label instructions. Some of them are based on zinc phosphide and other products. Just look for something labeled for ground squirrels. Go to the local garden center, hardware store, co-op. What do you got for ground squirrels? And then follow the label instructions. Usually they're grain-based baits, and you would put a tablespoon or two tablespoons or whatever the directions call for down the burrow. The helpful thing there is that the stuff goes down the burrow, so it's not being exposed to other wildlife.
We have, Scott, it's a great picture on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Dan in Mount Morris, Wisconsin, sent this photo. He says, my wife has tree frogs living in the hanging plants, and she's worried about what will happen to them when fall comes and it's time to get rid of the plants. That is the coolest picture.
That's a neat picture. You know, the attraction to the hanging plants is that you're watering the hanging plants. So with it as dry as it is, frogs are amphibians. They need some moisture, not as much as some amphibians, but they do need some moisture. The hanging plant's a great spot for them. I would not worry about them at all. Mine are currently living under the heavy cover that I have on the gas grill, where there's enough condensation and shelter under there. That's where they're holed up. So when I take the cover off the grill, zoom, they hop off. Once things cool off and it's time for them to find some area where they're going to spend the winter and hibernate, they will just disperse. So don't worry about it. There's nothing you could do about it anyway. Enjoy them while they're around the plants, and they're probably hopping up on the wall around outdoor lights and feeding during the night, and you've provided a little home for tree frogs. Enjoy them while you can.
Here we have another couple of photos. Ellen sent one. Last week in Douglas County, we had the experience shown in the photo. The bear had three cubs. I'm trying to get this photo, or here, let's move that down a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So, and she was breaking into cabins, helping herself to all that was in the refrigerator and cupboards. Then she and her babies would head down the way to the next cabin. While the drought was not as bad there as in southern Wisconsin, we had to wonder if her unusual, very bold behavior was related. The blueberry crop up there was terrible this year. There's quite a photo of the bear on top of a car.
Well, you know, it's hard to tell what the motivation for the bear is, but obviously it's a bear that's conditioned and has learned or was conditioned to humans and food being related. And there are a variety of possible explanations. In a bad bear year, that puts a little more pressure on the bears to find food. It also may be, you know, bears are, especially in the Northwoods, problem bears are moved around the countryside, trapped, live trapped, and moved. And they do that twice. It's a three strikes and you're out policy. So it's also possible that this bear had previous exposure somewhere else as a problem bear, and has lapsed back to its old ways, in which case this is a candidate also for removal to a less populated area, and they're tagged and so forth. I don't see any indication of tags or marking that particular bear, but if it were caught, they would certainly know that, and it could be moved from the offending area. So
somebody sent me a YouTube photo yesterday. I got it of a truck. Woman in the back of a truck, they're backing up to a bin, and she puts a ladder inside the garbage bin, and then they drive away, and three cubs climb out of it, and the mom was behind there, and they all take off. They couldn't get out.
Huh.
And so the people put a ladder in, and the bears climbed out.
Well, I mean, sometimes these, often we preach, you know, don't intervene in wildlife matters, but there are some cases like that, or a turtle or something trapped in your window well where you do have to help get them out. So all's well that ends well.
And Bill William Nischke sent us another photo, June 11th on the Rush River. Got a nice frog photo.
That is there. A dandy leopard frog. That's
dandy leopard.
Yep.
So I hope if you're near your computer, you'll go on our Facebook page to the Larry Mueller Show and take a look at all the great photos that are there. Alan in Boscobel has a suggestion for us. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I've heard tell that you can take a gallon milk jug of water to the ground squirrels and you pour it down their hole,
mm-hmm.
and that they'll try and evacuate back towards the milk jug, and you can actually catch them in the jug.
Well, it's worth a try.
It's worth a try.
as dry as it is, I'm not sure a gallon of water is enough to do the job. But hey, for a scrap milk jug and a gallon of water, it's worth a try. And it would be kind of entertaining to see them like a ship in the bottle. You'd have the ground squirrel in the jug.
There you go.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Mary in Danbury. I haven't been to Danbury in a while. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry and Scott. My question is that I'm wondering if I could have seen a little juvenile badger. We live near the St. Croix River and Governor Knowles and Creek, so we have a lot of public mm-hmm. land yeah. around us. And we had just stopped at a stop sign, so we were barely moving, and it crossed the road.
Uh-huh.
And my brief sighting, it was about a foot long and 8 inches high, and it definitely had light and dark areas on its face. But I was so intent to check out the tail, and it did have no rings. And so I'm wondering if it could have been a badger, and if not, what other options it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was in that family, you know, the way it walked.
Yeah, kind of short and rotund and short legs and close to the ground.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the tail that didn't have rings, was it kind of short and bottle brush-like?
Yeah, rather short.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if I mean, the giveaway, well, first of all, it certainly could have been a young badger. They're
yep.
found statewide. People are lucky to get a chance to see one. They're neat animals, but not highly visible. The giveaway, of course, is the black and white markings on the face, that the Bucky Badger markings, so to speak.
Yep.
And if you think you got a glimpse of dark and light on the face, then I think the odds are pretty good that you saw a young badger. The other likely candidate, and a far more abundant animal that moves the same way and is built the same way, is a woodchuck or groundhog.
Coloring's different.
The coloring, so I mean, if you describe the animal more as silvery gray with black accents, then we'd go with badger. If you describe it more as brownish or tannish or yellowish, then we'd go with woodchuck. But
yep.
I think you saw a badger. I'm willing to go with badger here, Larry. What do you think?
I'm going 95% sure on a badger.
Okay.
I think I will do that too. Thank you so much.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the World of Wildlife with Scott Craven. Thanks for listening in today. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post there and click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on our shows. But we'd love to see some photos. We've seen some great photos already today, and I'm sure there'll be more on the way. So join in. Shannon and Marshall, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry and Scott. Thanks for taking my call. Last week, we had a baby rabbit who had a mouse trap on his back leg. Since then, my husband was able to get the trap, the bunny's leg, but I'm wondering, is there a place to call that would come and, like, rescue a wild animal in your yard that's injured and help it out?
Well, there are a couple of possibilities.
Here in
whether
Marshall.
Or not you can get a house call kind of thing or not is questionable. Probably not, but there are certainly there are a couple of options. Either centers, rehabilitation centers that operate in particularly around population centers in the state, or individually licensed wildlife rehabilitators who are scattered throughout the state, and there may even be one or more right there in Marshall. And the DNR maintains lists of these people. So I think if there's also a website for the Rehabilitators Association, and you might be able to make contact with someone that way. But in the absence of any web access, check with your local DNR office and tell them you're trying to be in, get in touch with, just for future reference, licensed wildlife rehabilitators in the Marshall area, and then those would be the people you would go to. And if they say, well, I'm not doing birds, or I'm not doing mammals, or I've got all the raccoons I can handle, or whatever, they can usually pass you on to someone who will help out, or to one of the bigger centers that you could take the animal to.
There you okay. go. Thank you very much for calling. Jody in Superior, hi.
Hi. I just have kind of a cute badger story to tell you. Recently, I was in the Iron River, Wisconsin area with a bunch of friends. We were four-wheeling, and pretty dusty road, so we were spread pretty far apart. And I came around a corner and saw a hole in the side of the bank with a furry little head sticking out of it. And I'm a crazy critter person, so I hopped off, pulled my four-wheeler over, hopped off, ran over to the hole, got within about 4 feet, crouched down, and started talking to this cute little thing with the big beady eyes and the big claws. And this animal was just staring at me, and I just kept talking to it. And then I could hear a friend of mine coming next on the four-wheeler, and he came around the corner, and he said, "What in the heck are you doing? That's a badger you're talking to." So right away, I thought, you know, badger, mean. He kept going on his four-wheeler. I jumped on my four-wheeler, and I was going to take off, and I turned around, and this badger was just looking at me out of the hole. I thought it was the cutest thing. She just sat there while I talked to her and told her how cute she was.
Well, that is an interesting story.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that, knowing what I know about badgers, I'm not sure I would have approached quite that closely. And if it was a young one that didn't seem to know much better and was maybe sticking its head out for the first time, that's one thing. Had it been mom badger, you're probably not in a very good location. But again, as we said before, all's well that ends well. So it ends up a happy story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, and she was very cute.
Thanks, Jody.
All right, thank you.
Yep, bye-bye. And Ron in the town of Dunn, hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Regular listener, Larry, and always look forward to your show when Scott Craven is on.
Thank you.
This is a question about beavers on a tributary west of Lake Wabisa, about a mile.
Mm-hmm.
There are several spring-fed creeks that are not trout creeks by any stretch of the imagination that go into the west end of Lake Wabisa through the Wabisa wetlands. And this spring, a beaver dam appeared, and wondered if there is something that we should do and if there are people we should tell.
Well, there's probably nothing you should do in an immediate sense. I mean, beaver are interesting animals, and they do turn up in various areas down here in the southern part of the state with some regularity. There was a lodge in one of the wildlife areas not too far from you a few years back. Go back a few more years, there was even a group of beavers on Winger Creek off of Park Street in Madison, and they were cutting down all the trees along the drive there between Fish Hatchery Road and Park Street, and they were ultimately removed, and there have been beaver in the Arboretum. So they are around, and they're kind of fun to see, and their engineering skills are legendary. However, it usually becomes an issue for the landowner or property manager where the beavers are active, whether or not they're starting to cut timber that people don't want cut, whether they're flooding roads or plugging up culverts or other such things. And if they're affecting a trout stream, although you said they weren't trout streams, if they're affecting a trout stream and blocking flow and warming up the water, then the DNR fisheries people may get involved. So, you know, barring any of those problems, if they're not causing any such problems, they could be left alone. If they are, then it's up to the landowners to instigate some action. And in terms of who you might tell, I would just contact or get word to in an email or whatnot to the local wildlife manager for the county and just say, hey, just wanted you to know we've got a beaver colony on such and such a creek, and they'll file that away in case it does become an issue in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's a curiosity.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Ron. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Donna in Luck, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hey. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I deliver the mail up here, and at this time of year, there's a lot of, I think they're tree frogs, so they're green. Sometimes they're gray. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they change colors to camouflage, but they're in the mailboxes.
Mm-hmm.
And being so hot, I think that they would be just sweltering. Just, you know, it would kill them to be in there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I know mailboxes are kind of a smorgasbord of a buffet for them, for food.
Well, it's a kind of a secure place, and it's shady if it's in a shady location, or it's at least it's dark and presumably a little moist inside. It's the kind of place I'd expect them to be sheltered. If you come across them, that it appears that they had no access on their own other than maybe the door was open and they got in there, then I would scoot them out. But otherwise, these animals tend to know what's best for them, and they seek out the kind of habitat or environment that offers what they're looking for, either in temperature, moisture, or what have you. So, and to answer your question, although they're called gray tree frogs, there are a couple species in the state, and they often have the form of this brilliant lime green, which is so striking. Otherwise, they're a mottled gray that look much like the bark of a tree. Hence the name tree frog, but they can, in fact, go back and forth on that depending on their substrate. So anyway, they're interesting little animals, and I'm surprised we're getting so many calls and interest in them considering how dry it's been down here in the southern part of the state.
Streams into, you know, they go down into the lakes are about, well, they're dried up now.
Yeah.
Up here. And that's why that's why they moved in there for the shade.
Maybe they're hoping someone will mail them to northern Wisconsin where there's some water.
Oh, thanks a lot for calling, Donna.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. We have a really good group of mail carriers, rural mail carriers, who listen to the show regularly, and it's always fun. We have Steve and Appleton. It's fun to hear from them. But let's hear from Steve next. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning. I have a snapping turtle question.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of open water swimming, and if you ever have done it, you can have some anxiety until you get experienced and get over it. And then snapping turtles are one of my anxieties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, occasionally I'll be looking down, and you're like, yeah, boy, I wonder what's down there. Well, forget about it, relax, just work on your stroke. And I might spend an hour in the water swimming across the lake with a canoe by me and that kind of thing. And then I was swimming recently on a shallow lake, and I'm like, boy, there's got to be snapping turtles in here. And sure enough, my hand touches something hard on the bottom, and I sprinted for about 100 yards because I had this anxiety. how realistic is that there's, is that something would possibly lose a finger or whatever?
No. Of the things that might cause someone some anxiety, being having some dangling appendage removed by a snapping turtle while swimming is probably not something to lose any sleep over. In his book, The Reptiles and Amphibians of Wisconsin, by Dick Vogt, that came out back in the 80s and is still a really nice book if you can find it, Vogt talked about his tactic for finding big snapping turtles in a shallow lake or marsh, which was to go in barefoot in a bathing suit and just essentially feel around with his feet in the muck until, ooh, that's hard, and then it's kind of round, and I think it's a turtle. And then he would reach down and figure out which end was which and bring the turtle up. And generally speaking, when his conclusion and his advice was that when they're in the water, they're not particularly aggressive and not a huge risk to swimmers and such things. And of all the people I know who have had problems with snapping turtles over the years, me included, I suffered a really ugly bite as a kid. But that was a turtle my dad had lugged home in a trash can, and I saw a turtle, and it had me before I knew it, and it was a bad situation. And they're very aggressive out when they're high and dry, looking for a nest in the spring, or somebody's removed them. But in the water, they seem to be fairly calm. Now, if you go to the famous YouTube video, and I think the guy actually developed it into a TV show, the Turtle Man from Kentucky and Tennessee, and see how he's swimming around in the slimy, god-awful swamps and pulling turtles out. He doesn't really have any problem until he's pulled them out of the water, and then they start to get a little anxious about the whole thing. So, bottom line, Steve, I think that you can swim with in a much more relaxed state, not worrying too much about the turtles.
Yeah, I always, when I see them in late June, they come out the nest and they're by a road, walking across the road. I always stop my bike and hurry them, pick them up, carry across the road the direction they're going, because I mean, that's really a risky time for them when they come out.
It is a very risky time for them, and one can only hope that they would reciprocate your kindness when they're out looking for nests and leave you alone when you're in the lake with them.
Do you know anything about purple loosestrife? Is that pretty well gone now, or is that?
No, I wish it was, but there's still plenty of it around. It's an invasive wetland plant that unfortunately is rather pretty in terms of the
hardly any of it anymore on my bike.
Well, that's good. I mean, there have been aggressive programs to try and remove it in some places.
It's been very successful, actually.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah. Take care. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. There's an insect that will eat purple loosestrife and nothing else.
We hope.
We hope.
We hope.
So far, so good. You can only hope. We have some photos. Here's another. The gray tree frog up on my Facebook page. Cindy sent it in. This little guy was in my pot of peppers. My husband has seen him since, and he's grown a little bit. So there's also a baby woodchuck picture from Sherry on our Facebook page as well. So get on the Facebook page today. We're getting some great wildlife photos, and they're all up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And we'll be with Scott Craven right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Seems like we're never at a loss for topics to cover about our wonderful Wisconsin wildlife. Scott Craven, a great person to point things out and explain what we might be seeing. He's a wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor from the UW Extension. Great to have him with us, and thank you so much for listening. And Scott, we have lots to talk about. We're a little older, but we don't go back to 1937 for sure. We're not nearly that old, but 1937 was a great year for conservation, wasn't it?
It was a big year. There were some things that started in 1937 that are still critically important today, very important. And I just wanted to bring up three of them. This is kind of one I'm involved with, and the other two are just, I think, of general interest. For one thing, the Wildlife Society, which is my professional society, was founded back in 1937 with Aldo Leopold's help, among many others. Currently, there are about 10,000 members in the Wildlife Society, and it's the 75th anniversary this year, obviously, and we've got a big celebration planned at the October National Conference out in Portland, Oregon, so I'm looking forward to that.
Cool.
But the Wildlife Society does a lot of good things, and it's a professional forum for biologists to share information and publish our professional journals and those kinds of things. Of more day-to-day interest, particularly for outdoors people, the Pittman-Robertson Act, otherwise known as the Federal Aid and Wildlife Restoration Act, was passed in 1937. The PR program today still generates tens of millions of dollars that the federal government collects by collecting an 11% excise tax on arms, ammunition, those kinds of outdoor implements that then is passed back to the state conservation departments to fund various programs in terms of wildlife research, in terms of shooting ranges and other hunter education, those kinds of things, a portion to the states based on how many license holders they have. So Pittman-Robertson and the comparable fisheries program, the Dingell-Johnson legislation, which came along later, are still very important in funding what gets done in Wisconsin and
Absolutely.
Every other state. And then the last one I wanted to mention was that Ducks Unlimited, one of many species or species group-specific conservation organizations, was also founded in 1937. And since that point, DU has raised about $3.3 billion with a B, dollars, yeah, to conserve about 12.4 million with an M acres of wetland habitat across North America.
Isn't that something?
And it's pretty amazing. And DU is just one. We mentioned this, I think, a program or two ago as I was looking through Outdoor News recently. There were a whole list of banquets and fundraisers, yeah, over the next month for groups like the Rough Grouse Society, National Wildlife Turkey Federation, DU, Trout Unlimited, Pheasants Forever. And there's dozens of them. And if you want to stimulate the economy, have a good time some night, and really do something useful for conservation, go to one of these banquets. They're always looking for new blood to come out and have a good time and spend a few bucks and win something. And it really gets back to helping things on the ground, like DU's 75 years of conserving wetland habitat. So those three things, the Wildlife Society, the founding of DU, and that Pittman-Robertson Act and all that money that's come back to Wisconsin, it was a big year. Back in 37. And you're sure you don't remember that?
I was born much later, thankfully. Denny and Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Denny. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, my wife wanted me to catch these mice that were running across the patio.
Mm-hmm.
And when I put out some of those sticky traps, and mm-hmm, I caught three of them, and they weren't mice. They were tiny little, I think, some type of a shrew with a cone-shaped, furry little nose, and they,
yep,
were tiny.
Yep, those are shrews.
Mm-hmm.
And so I pulled the traps, but she's concerned that they're going to get into the house, or they're trying to get into the house. Is there any reason to be concerned about that? And
shrews are kind of good guys in a way.
Yeah, shrews are good guys, and I think, you know, the sticky traps have a place in rodent and small mammal control, but usually indoors. After the things have penetrated your defenses, a sticky trap can be helpful on top of a pipe in the basement or at a corner of the garage or something. But put outside, they're kind of indiscriminate. So, you know, you were after mice, but you got shrews. And the reality is that the bigger shrew, the one that's about mouse size but has the same conical snout, is actually around eating the mice. That's
a short-tailed
shrew. They're actually helping you get rid of the mice. The little tiny guys that, if I've got the right species, there's two of them that are about at best the size of your little finger, with a long tail, tiny little things. They're out there eating the spiders and grubs and, mm-hmm, beetles and assorted other things that your wife probably doesn't want on the patio either. So, much better to target the mice either after they get indoors or with some traps in a there are different types of multiple catch traps that the mice actually have to go in to get caught, you know, rather than being out in the open. So you can still deal with the mice, and if you can, leave the shrews alone.
Yeah.
The short answer on your question is, will the shrews get inside and cause a problem in the house? Only very rarely. And they're not going to gnaw on things. They're not rodents, so they're not going to chew holes in the house or chew holes in the insulation under the refrigerator like a mouse might. So if you do get them inside, they can be removed, but they're not going to cause anywhere near the problems that a mouse would.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And John in Eagle River, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Interesting program. Your guest sounds like quite an expert on woodchucks and everything else. I've got a question about woodchucks, which you may be able to answer.
I cannot tell you how much wood a woodchuck chucks if a woodchuck could chuck wood, but go ahead.
Otherwise.
I can tell you the answer to that.
Okay.
A woodchuck would chuck all the wood he could chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood.
Oh, excellent. So what's on your mind regarding woodchucks?
That was the question.
Oh.
So it was more a joke than anything else.
I'm sorry. I stole some of your thunder.
No. You shared it. It was nice that you did that because you said you didn't know, and I gave you the answer.
Okay. Well, then we were able to help each other out, so that worked out great.
And, John, exactly. you should go on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show right now. There's a picture of an orphan woodchuck. They were fostering at the Four Lakes Wildlife Center in Madison. He's since been released on the property in the county, and we see him living under a wood pile. But it's a very cute picture.
It is.
Is he chucking or not?
He's chugging, actually.
He's chugging.
He looks like he's drinking from a milk bottle.
So they're feeding him by hand.
I'd like to adopt one of those because I need some woodchucks.
Thanks, John. Thanks a lot for calling. While we're on it, the photos, here's another one. A photo, really cool photo from Michael. Said, I had a great time watching these two mink hunting along the shore of the Twin Valley Lake at Governor Dodge State Park. And those are little guys, young mink, but what a cool picture.
That is a cool picture. There have been some really nice ones today.
Oh, there are so many. Listen, if you've been listening, you don't have to be a member of Facebook to go to my Facebook page. So I would, if you're worried about that, why, just go and take a look because there's a lot of great photos.
Radio's never been the best medium for sharing photos, but the Facebook connection does make it possible, and there are some really nice ones today.
Kendra in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi there. My question is squirrel related. I'm a friend of squirrels. I give them free rein at the feeders. I fully expect every spring when I plant my containers that they're going to do some digging. Mm-hmm. But I have never seen them dig like they have this summer. I mean, it's every time I water, it's in the pots, it's in the ground. Pretty sizable holes, always right next to the plant. So I was just curious if it is drought related and heat related. What are they looking for, and or do I just have a really bad group of poorly mannered squirrels this summer?
Well, it could be bad behavior, but I think it's related to the moisture situation. I've noticed as I've been just watering my garden that as you're sprinkling, the robins gather from all the yard and just kind of form a ring around me, hoping to dart in and find a little moisture before it soaks into the ground. And I think the squirrel's capability of doing a little digging is not only an issue of the moisture, but also the thought that, hey, maybe this is moist enough to dig in at least. I'm going to find a nut from last year or a tuber or a root or something else that might be food stuff. But I think it is related primarily to the moisture provision. And as such, I mean, it's another byproduct of the drought conditions we've had that we're going to have to grin and bear it here until things improve.
There you go. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it, Kendra. And, Tom in Random Lake, let's go to you. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Hey, guys. I got a bat question for you.
Okay.
A couple weeks ago, on a Sunday morning, I noticed a bat that was flapping around up on my roof, and I know they had been living under an eave.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched it, and it looked like it was pretty in distress, but after about 45 minutes, it ended up working its way down, fell off the roof, and basically looked pretty diseased and died.
Mm-hmm.
So there had been a lot of bat feces underneath the roof where it was falling off where this area was. Now I notice there's hardly any of them, and I noticed on Sunday there's another bat up on my roof that's dead. Wondering if there's a disease that's killing them or...
Well, I mean, there are a couple of things to think about here, Tom. First of all, this is the time of year when young bats are first taking wing. So as a result, the new regulations about people dealing with bat infestations in homes states that bat proofing or bat exclusion cannot take place until after August 15th in recognition of the fact that this year's crop of juvenile bats is leaving the roost now and taking wing for the first time. So given the extreme heat and other potential distress, one explanation is that these are young bats you're seeing that are having some just emerging for the first time and struggling perhaps. That's one possibility. The other thing I'd be a little bit more anxious about is that bats are occasionally implicated with rabies. It's not common, but it does happen. And when a bat is rabid, it tends to become semi-immobilized or semi-paralyzed, and as a result, they often fall or drop out of roosts or end up on the ground or garage floor or barn floor where people come in contact with them, which is one reason why advice about a grounded bat, a bat that's behaving abnormally, is, hey, be careful with it, and that's a bat that should probably be submitted to the State Lab of Hygiene for rabies testing. So I'd be a little more concerned about that. The third possibility, that there's some disease that's affecting those bats in your roost, and of course I understand the sensitivity to that because of all the press about white nose syndrome threatening our bat populations. But the white nose syndrome is a winter phenomenon that wouldn't be in play right now. But I've not heard of anything else that that might be a problem. But if you're concerned about that, then I'd suggest you navigate your way through the DNR website or through the local DNR office and get in touch with one of the bat team members in the Bureau of Endangered Resources in the DNR and make the report and also, therefore, or make the inquiry as to whether they've heard of anything else going on that might be a little unusual. Otherwise, I think the earlier two explanations, either young bats moving around for the first time or the low potential that it's a rabies situation, might be more plausible.
Yeah, I don't think it was the young ones. The one that fell off was a pretty good-sized one.
Okay.
The one that's up there, I can't tell. And the one that fell off, you know, like it was just laying on the sidewalk, so I was looking at it. I actually took some pictures of it, and it was like, bearing its fangs like it was going to try and bite or something. I didn't really go closer than probably about 3 feet to it, but it eventually just died, and I ended up disposing of it. But it, like I say, in the one that's up there, I don't know how big that is because I can't really see.
Well, then I think it's worth, especially if you have a fresh specimen that could be tested, I think it's worth getting it into the system just for your own peace of mind.
Sounds good.
All right, thanks a lot, Tom, for calling. And we have... we have callers online here. Diane and Mercer, let's go to you. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I organize a survey every year for the turtle flamble foliage for people to check in for purple lustrace. And every year we have a work day where we work with the DNR and the Land Conservation Department and get rid of it. And I was in Milwaukee the day after we did our work day. I was at Hummel Park, and there was purple lustrife growing right around the lagoon, and I was pretty upset that I think it was planted there as part of their kind of restoration with natural plants.
I hope not.
I don't understand how it would have got there. It's nowhere else in the area at all.
Well, I mean, it is spread pretty easily by birds and whatnot and things that may carry seeds and mud on their feet or whatnot. But I think that that's you're knowledgeable about it. So I think it's clearly something that should be reported to the property manager for that site. And if you have the expertise in organizing a control party, it sounds like it might be something that could be nipped in the bud, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't live down there, so that's the problem.
Oh, okay. So you were just visiting in Milwaukee.
Yes.
Well,
I'd still call if you could.
If you know the name of the park or something, you know, call the park department or the DNR and say, hey, I'm a little worried about this population of purple lustrife that I saw, and it seems to be, it looks to me, because I have some experience in this, that it could be controlled, and I think somebody then would.
I did do that, and each place told me they didn't really have the resources or that the other people should deal with it. Kind of concerned.
Oh. That's too bad.
Well, but there are certainly, even though the Parks Department or whatever entity it was might employ or invoke the budget limitations, there are plenty of conservation-minded people and groups in the Milwaukee area that that might be mobilized to do something.
Even
about
something
that.
Like the wild ones, you might find.
The wild ones or some of the nature centers like Todd Ware or the Burnham Botanical Gardens or places over in that area that would have the wherewithal and the membership to do something about it.
The wild ones, maybe I'll try that.
Yeah, that's a plant group, plant interest group.
Okay. Just one more. I've been seeing 30 to 40 turkeys together with all different size young ones. Hanging around oak trees up here.
Oh, that's cool. The Mercer area.
Well, I have a cabin in Price County. We were up last week, and I saw more turkey broods on the side of the road between Park Falls and Minocqua in a matter of 2 days than I've seen here in southern Wisconsin all summer. So
that's really cool.
They seem to be doing surprisingly well up in the North Woods.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Diane. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it very much. We have a follow-up on the injured animal question and what to do with an injured animal. Got a caller from Marshall And Sherry posted on our Facebook page, in Dane County, Animal Services can help by picking up injured wildlife and taking them to Four Lakes Wildlife Center at the Humane Society. Mm-hmm. Marshall is in Dane County, so Sherry says, I work for Animal Services, and we pick up lots of injured wildlife.
Good. Okay. Well, Dane County hopefully is not an anomaly in terms of the level of service provided around the state, but in other counties, people have to track down similar resources. But that answers the question for our Marshall caller.
Yeah. Dave in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Oh, I just want to comment on the previous caller who was afraid that the purple loosestrife was planted as a restoration project of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
In the Milwaukee County Parks, we are acutely aware of the invasive species problem, but like government entities all over the place, we've been cut to bare bones where if someone sees something like that, we just don't have the personnel to pull it up anymore. So, mm-hmm. We know what purple loosestrife is, and, having been made aware of it, we'll do something about it.
Okay. I couldn't imagine otherwise, so keep up the good work with what resources you're given.
Absolutely, Dave. Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate that very much. I know how that goes because at the university, our resources have been.
Yeah, if people expect them to be out, mowing roadsides or
whatever.
Planting grass or doing whatever, they just can't drop everything to go.
Do everything.
Pull up purple loosestrife.
Listener Jerry wonders if he should dilute his hummingbird feeder nectar if they're coming more often because it's dry and they're thirsty. Should he make it less strong?
I don't think so. It's a pretty dilute solution to begin with. I don't think that's an issue.
And Thomas wonders, do I need to be concerned about my Springer Spaniel getting caught in a wolf trap near Clam Lake while grouse hunting this fall? If so, where else should I go to avoid this problem?
Well, there is some concern over the fact that trapping has been added to the toolbox in terms of the wolf harvest, that the traps will be out there. But these are leg hole traps that would be used, and leg hole traps are designed to restrain the animal, not injure it. And if they're set and used properly, they don't. All the wolves that have been caught for research purposes and radio marked were caught in leg hole traps. So the issue here is that a hunter who's concerned about it and is hunting in a wolf area should become at least nominally familiar with how a trap works. So if their dog is caught, they can safely and efficiently let it go.
Let it go. Jim in Montreal would like to know if he can trap and eat wild rabbits in the spring. On his property, I assume.
On your own property, Jim, rabbits are part of the exclusion clause, basically, that they can be hunted or controlled or trapped or whatever. The only day you can't is gunfire the day before the gun deer season. But elsewhere, or at other times of the year, you can control rabbits or capture them or whatever you want to do on your own property. The consuming of rabbits is a personal preference issue. The reason, or one of the historically one of the reasons the rabbit season is late in the year is to avoid human contact with the ectoparasites on the rabbit that might transmit tularemia. You might want to check with your local vet or medical doctors just how much of an issue that is, and if you decide to consume the rabbits that you're removing from your yard, so be it.
Yeah, so be it. And with that, wow.
That was a fast hour and a half.
Judith wanted me to tell people to look at our Facebook page for one thing. My goodness, there's so many great photos there. Look in the right column posts by others in order to be able to see those many photos. There are so many out there, and I really appreciate it. And my gosh, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you're gonna have a lot of fun looking at those photos. And Scott, it's always a great pleasure. You'll back the first Wednesday, September 5th. Oh my gosh, I think that's the first Wednesday of the month.
Well, I'll be here. That was a good program.
Yeah,
today.
Really
fast,
good.
Fast 90 minutes.
Yeah, it was a very fast 90 minutes, and I appreciate what you do, and I'm looking forward to us getting together again in about a month. Tomorrow at 11, financial counselor Connie Kilmark with us. She'll help us figure out how our emotions impact our financial decisions. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.